Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast. Fish are amazing creatures with a diversity of colors, shapes, and sizes. They truly are a diverse group of animals, and so are humans. This podcast is more about people than fish, which is also the case in fisheries, believe it or not. Any fisheries manager will tell you, it's about working with people. The fish are the easy part.
Here we focus on people and on extremely important topics, including the benefits of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the field of fisheries and aquatic sciences. Some topics may be uncomfortable at times, but this will be a safe zone from which everyone can learn. Although this is an initiative led by graduate students and supported by the American Fisheries Society and the Fisheries Podcast, it applies everywhere and to everyone and transcends fisheries.
We strive for everyone to feel involved and included, no matter your country of origin, age, ethnicity, gender, religion, sexuality, and/or disability. Hosts and guests are sharing their personal views, which they hold as their own.
Humans struggle between what is right and wrong. Our personal morals and ethics are shaped by cultural norms and the ones that surround us, including our family, friends, classmates, and colleagues. Our podcast would like to critique your philosophy by challenging some of your personal beliefs regarding right and wrong.
We are so glad you chose to listen and open your mind to these very important conversations. Thank you for joining us.
All right, everyone. We had a virtual annual meeting for the American Fisheries Society in the fall. That's where I met Dr. Yvonne Arizmendi. What a perfect opportunity in this virtual space to bring in Dr. Arizmendi to discuss a very important topic. Before I introduce our speaker today, I'd like to mention how we're going to shake things up a bit for this week's seminar. I mentioned earlier the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion podcast team will be on hand. So we have a group of podcasters that discuss similar issues that Dr. Arizmendi will talk about today. So Dr. Yvonne Arizmendi is an aquatic ecologist who currently holds an assistant professor position at Oregon State University. He grew up in southern Chile, and his interest for aquatic ecology was sparked as he witnessed the invasion of salmonids, trout, and salmon in his native waters. He successfully obtained a bachelor's degree in fisheries engineering and a doctorate degree in forest sciences from Austral University in Chile. Currently, he leads scientific research to improve our understanding about the role of natural variability and human-related disturbances on aquatic systems. Specifically, he focuses on global environmental change, invasion biology, and aquatic food webs. But he's also interested in people and the people who use the resources and actually study the resources in our profession, which has led to emergent research on diversity, equity, and inclusion in the sciences. And he has some really good papers out there specifically on these topics. So to date, Dr. Arizmendi has led over 70 scientific publications, received various awards, including the Savory Outstanding Young Faculty Award from his college there at Oregon State. Recently this fall, had the pleasure of listening to his presentation as he received the Emily Moore Prize from the American Fisheries Society. It's a career achievement award that recognizes efforts in the promotion of demographic diversity within the American Fisheries Society. So that's awesome. And listeners, podcast listeners, if you have access to the virtual annual meeting content from the fall, you can go back and you can listen to Dr. Arizmendi in action, DEI Day as well, which was that first Tuesday of the meeting. As a mentor and advisor, Dr. Arizmendi helps students become the professionals they desire to be, enhances the student diversity in his department by mentoring and advising both graduate and undergraduate students. His students have come from all over: Chile, Argentina, Colombia, Malaysia, Pakistan, Russia, and Vietnam. His research lab includes members of a variety of identities and backgrounds, including racial minorities, gender minorities, veterans, and international students. He's mentored 2 postdocs, 14 grad students, mentored 19 undergraduates, and he contributes to several DEI initiatives, including a summer camp to engage high school students of underserved communities. He received the Oregon State University Outreach and Engagement Vice Provost Team Award for Excellence in 2020. He self-identifies as a Latinx scientist with a strong commitment to serve as an example to students that science is available to anyone. So let's please welcome Dr. Yvonne Arizmendi as he joins the Clemson University's Department of Forestry and Environmental Conservation to give our seminar today. I'll hand the reins over to Dr. Arizmendi and appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. Thank you for inviting me. You will see my accent is from Southern Chile, if you're not familiar with that. Again, I'm really pleased to be here and trying to convey some messages related to diversity and inclusion in our profession. I would like to start saying that I don't need to convince you or trying to teach you about the word diversity, because you work in natural resources, fisheries, forestry, and related fields that already know this, the importance of diversity. I'm just to have a positive message in this introductory slide related to the science is benefit having a diverse workforce. And this is going to be my message on that. But before details, I would like you to, I have a couple of questions for you to reflect and think about. Before that, I would like to acknowledge my collaborators in the design perspective. I have my partner in crime too, Brooke Penaluna, who is also a research biologist and working for a federal agency, and my colleague, statistician from the Department of Statistics also, while just working in one paper that will show some preliminary results. And also my research lab, you see we have an extended family from people of different color, faces, and interests. And I think this is really important for motivate people to talk about issues related to diversity, is basically experience that in your own backyard. I would like you to picture a scientist. What is your vision about how or what does a scientist looks like? And this is a question that was posed to thousands of kids from K to 12 trying to draw a scientist, how they envision and see a scientist. And they have more than 5,000 drawings. Only 28 of them draw a female scientist, and all of which draw a female scientist were drawing by girls. Many other studies, this was early on the 70s, many other studied trying to repeat this effort year by year. There is a new, more recent meta-analysis that showing these over time have been changed or not. So this is more than 50 studies so far that trying to do the same test. The meta-analysis basically showing that women are seen as a scientist by young in their ages. But you see the proportion of students who draw a male scientist is start growing after 6 years. So before that, we have the demography represented that basically girls and boys can be whatever they want to be, right? And 50-50. But then you're starting to see this shift. So children are drawing female scientists more often of recent when they're getting older. Probably one of the surprising findings is that girls are those that are driving this shift. So girls are not picturing girls when they age. In general, as a student get older again, most of them tend to draw male scientists. So what are those drivers? You think about a little bit about that. After that, I would like you to ask some questions. And these are more recent drawings of scientists, but you still see that the diversity in colors are not also important. So we see also females, but always or most of the time with lab coats, white people, right? So what we see, what we interpret is really depending on what is the context of that. Based on the information and how I present the information, you may have a different view. The message here is the expectation can change according to the way in which we selectively interpret the data. And this also is valid for everything in our life, how we construct ourselves from our childhood. Where we see different things is the same image. It's basically the concept that we know very well in ecology that is bias, right? The bias, we defining concept related to the precision and also how accurate is the information to what we have. We have four examples here with a place that we are unbiased, so you can have not target the red circle with the truth, right? But also it's imprecise. And we have bias, right? Because most of the measurements are in this direction, but also imprecise and so on, right? And we know this when we talk about biases and when we talk about science in general. Indeed, in ecological sciences, people are well aware about the importance of biases in science. Many of people believe that their own studies are less prone to biases than a study by others. Talking about science perspective, the unconscious origin of biases necessitate external intervention to combat them. That's a conclusion of this study. We're talking about biases in ecological sciences here. But I would argue that the same type of biases we have as humans, and we can define those biases too in different terms with the same idea. Thinking about how we interpret information and based on how we grew up, values, neighbors, where we grew up, etc. What are biases? If we talk a little bit about social scientists somehow. So basically, we have two types of biases. The first one is the bias that is intent and have an impact. This bias is explicit, so fully and clearly expressed or demonstrated. You can observe those biases. The explicit biases are deliberate, conscious, intentional, easy to recognize by in ourselves. We know when we have biases. I don't like this person just because I'm biased, for example. And these are easy prejudice, and it has an intention, it has an action. But there are other type of biases that we are not aware of, but also have an impact. So the impact is without the intention. And I would argue that most of the problem that we have with the diversity and inclusion is related to these implicit or unconscious biases. So implicit biases means that they are implied but not plainly expressed. They are without awareness. If we think about these images I showed before, you don't meant to interpret the information. It's just unconsciously you do. So implicit biases are unconscious. Again, not deliberate, unintentional. These are difficult to recognize in ourselves, which is really important because we are all biases. We have biases. We need to find which one are your biases. And often these biases contradict our own belief and intention and efforts. And that's a problem, right? Because it's a conflict between having these biases but don't know them, but your values meant to be not to have them. So this is one of the pieces of information that I think that will explain what we see in our profession in terms of the workforce. And the other part that is being more deliberately now stated came from the social science. It's basically been studying these for a while. Unconscious, again, implicit bias came also for the social construction of gender and race. And this is well known for social scientists, but in our science, in ecology, we have less knowledge on that. So I will just summarize this a little bit, this concept. We are talking about the legacy of foundational ideas of slavery of African in the 18th century. This is not a while ago. We're talking about 200 years ago, a couple of generations, right? And these follow questions about the humanity of Africans in the 19th century persist. So we're talking about 100 years ago. And this being proved for many social scientists. So we have this legacy now in generational cultural legacies. Similarly, we have the same social structure and individual identities in Western society were deliberately had devaluated women while benefit men. And this is also well studied in social sciences. So in both cases, the persistence of these socially constructed racisms and sexisms have left residues in science. And many people have showed that plus those biases I explained to you before, that's unconscious, can somehow explain the recent trends in the lack of inclusion and diversity in science, in the science workforce. So let's do a different example. We're thinking about the impact of these biases, the biases that are unconscious, but they impact are universal. And this is one example from the art world that's supposed to be more inclusive, more liberal, right, more artistic. So if I ask you, what is the proportion of women musicians in the most prestigious orchestra of the world? And you throw a number, let's see, in the 70s, if you think a number, I will tell you this, it was 5%. In 10 years later, that's improved a little more, so it's 12%. But then it was a big shift. I will tell you about that in a minute. And today is almost 40%. A simple change in the way that auditions were performed just basically cope with the biases, unconscious biases. It's basically having blind auditions. So blind auditions with people without shoes moving to the theater with a curtain in front. So judges can listen to the music, but not see who is performing. And that's only change increased this number from 12% to almost 40% of the musicians now being women. that is a simple example about how these unconscious biases are, again, unconscious, but their impact were universal. So if we move now to the research workforce, in general, worldwide, we have a research workforce dominated by men and worldwide. And here is the North America, Western Europe, supposed to be developed countries. And we have 32% of the research workforce constituted by women. Pay attention to this number. 32 is about less than one third of the whole workforce here. And this is in general with different continents, different culture, different, again, biases, probably cultural biases, unconscious biases, and all of that related to this. But we have this workforce in general. There is a lot of new studies coming now, the interest of what's happened in our own discipline. This is a recent paper by a postdoc here in Oregon State and collaborators in 2020 in bioscience that trying to find what we know about natural resources and disciplines over time, how these change. First, you see the number of articles in the bottom is usually between less than 5%. And then in the last year, we see a little bit of increase in the numbers. And in 2019, we have almost 25, 27. So it's in a growing effort to understand these biases, talking about these issues in natural resources, people that are trying to address these issues. So if you take the case of fisheries, for example, I would argue that we can somehow represent what's going on in the rest of the natural resources area. This will be probably idiosyncratic itself based on discipline, but will serve as an example. And how we can measure this? Well, I think I will argue again that we need to learn from the past in order to know where we are and where we will like to be in the future. So we learn about the past and in order to know the future. So learning from the past in fisheries is really important because our fisheries, the history in fisheries will basically reflect the social and geographical history of North America. And this is the oldest society, professional society in the US. And with a clear apply science perspective, right? We're talking about the hatchery-based understanding in here. This is one example. And it was founded in 1870. So a lot of history here. The first woman president came after 57 years of the society, and the second woman 50 years after that. So the first woman is Emmeline Moore. It's kind of an outlier, even think about the rest of the history of these. In 2023, we will have the first Black president of AFS after 153 years. So I can argue that this history of our society, of a professional society, also mimic what's happening in our society with some lags too. So what we learn is that the demography of AFS, and this is American Fisheries Society, again, have shifted over time. And here's one just graphical example. You see in 1930, we see the annual meeting of the society in Toronto. And you see one person here, this is Emmeline Moore. And you see the other woman here are wives of one of the scientists. So 4 or 17 are women in this photo. And in the 2016, we see almost half of the people in this photo attending to the American Fisheries Society in Missouri were women in this case. But also you see a little bit more colorful photo there with people, not only white people. We see similarly in our local chapters that an increased participation of women in historically white state, including, for example, Oregon, my own state. In the 1960s, this is a joint meeting between the American Fisheries Society and the Wildlife Society in Oregon chapter. And you see here, the photo is basically representing what was there, almost all men, white men, people there. In 2016, I took this photo from the banquet from the society, and I was counting every single table to see what kind of have an idea about the participation of women. And it's 30% of the photo are women. And again, go back to the 30% about the workforce in general, we just keep consistent with that. That could be anecdotal, of course, but you will see that these numbers keep repeating now in the future. If we talk about diversity and leadership, this is one example of this is the Fisheries Journal, is the journal magazine that is represent the society, basically. It was founded in 1976. This is the first issue highlighting the past president of the society. And you can see you see all men here. This is the 150th anniversary last year in 2020. They tried to acknowledge the leadership of these. And that was with the best intent. attention, because many people from the diversity and inclusion awareness, people that are being represented, that was part of this conversation, but they try to highlight leadership and see a little bit more women here, but still you see kind of a society dominated by white. If we take the context in related to the participation of women and not just American Fisheries Society, and now my expanding a little bit more, and here you see in the bottom graph the Ecological Society of America, that's basically will be more a bigger society in terms of membership. The participation of BIPOC is way more, any woman in this case, is way higher than the AFS. AFS is 25%. This is the STEM workforce in the US in 2013. So the number of people with graduating with a PhDs level, so we have 30%, and census here in the 50%. For race and ethnicity, here is AFS. Okay, again, this is the census. About 36% is non-white in the census, but then you can still see the increase in white participation in STEM in general, and AFS is 9% only the non-white people, and in the ESA a little bit better, again showing the same trend than in the case of women. So even our society is becoming more diverse. We are way up from where it's supposed to be a racial equity, if you think about just the population, composition of population. We started these issues thinking about diversity and inclusion in 2014, 2015, thinking about trying to show this for the fisheries itself. And what we did is basically we're trying to find all the positions in these, all the institutions with fisheries and wildlife programs that offer programs in the US. So we went to every single website of those institutions and classify faculty positions based on race and gender. Of course, we have limitations related to non-binary genders, but this is what was available for us. Or the other point that we did that time was looking for federal employees too in an independent data sets. Again, there are two independent data sets. One is the faculty composition of university that provided graduate degrees in fisheries and wildlife, those from federal agency that we use a FOIA request to ask for gender, and those are related to fisheries profession. So here again is the census. We are almost 50-50. This is the number of PhD in 2010. And we have more women PhDs than men in this case in biological sciences. So arguable, those are the potential occupiers of these positions, right? So there's no a lack of people with the skills that we need. These are the federal scientist managers. So 26% from almost 1,700 scientists in the federal workforce, only 26% are women. Again, close to 30 again. And these are for the other data sets for a different categories. Research faculty here, you see 31. And then from research faculty to adjunct or affiliated faculty, 24. And then assistant professors for most recent hires, basically 27%, associate professor, arguable, those being reflecting what's happened during between 10 and 20 years ago, 30%, and full professor about 20, 30 years ago, 15%. You see a little bit improvement, but then no much more there. And again, 27% for assistant professors and 26% for federal agencies. These are remarkable, similar, really consistent trends, real numbers from real people. And more than 70% of tenure track faculty are men. There's a lack of diversity consistent between academia and federal government. Lack of women at various levels, especially at top level. You see 15% only for full professors. This is for gender and also for race. Also, we found similar trends, right? These are, again, the U.S. demography, the demography of the U.S. This is the participation in biological sciences. We are really kind of really close on that. And federal scientists are 9% about from all of these people here. For assistant professor, again, it's really similar, associate professor and full professor. So we are seeing these decreases consistent between these two. Almost 90% of tenure track faculty are white. Lack of diversity is also, again, consistent between the two data sets. We think about, well, if you now trying to combine the ideas that I mentioned related to unconscious biases and our social construction of race and gender in the US, is this the perfect storm related to how we can see this number? So it's kind of an explanation of that. We argue for that. And this paper, by Chelsea Octavia in 2020, also trying to disentangle some ideas about having argument for and against diversity in natural resources. So what are the reasons that people think about against and for having a diverse workforce? And these, again, are fisheries, wildlife, forestry, range, and other natural resources. So argument against are fewer in general, but you still see about people against having diversity, a workforce is about no more than 10%, probably 5% percentage. Most of the arguments are for having a diverse workforce and talking about relevance, representation. There is a lot of argument about representation, good for the profession, and other four. So this is a more like philosophical point of view. This argument analysis is related to wording that people use. So there's a lot of here that is can be also unpacked. I would argue as a quantitative person that we need to use also quantitative measure of that. And we were searching about that, about what are the advantages of a diverse workforce in sciences. And there is studies that have shown that with more diverse workforce, we can generate new ideas, we can promote innovation, and we can lead to better problem solving. That happened at different levels, not only in academia, but also in business, other type of organizations. In the case of academia, there are some studies that have shown that if you have a more diverse workforce, you can enhance the scientific productivity. And scientific productivity, I meant number of papers published and also the impact of those papers. Also, having a more diverse, a multicultural or multi-level racial composition of authorship in papers is really important because you can increase the science to be a better high impact. So the high impact of having a more diverse workforce also is translated to a higher impact research. We try to test this hypothesis and see how we are doing in fishery. And this is kind of a new work we're trying to do now. So everything that is coming now is going to be in preparation or in review. We're trying to understand these collaboration networks, because collaboration network in science will embody the dominant ideas in fisheries science. Basically, again, I just mentioned it that 1870, the first issue of Transaction of the American Fisheries Society is the oldest journal in fisheries. So from 1872. So we have a time series of authorship that we were exploring too here. And the first art, just to give you an example of this, is the first article in Transaction led by a woman was 47 years after. And guess what? Emmeline Moore was the person who led this. And you would see Emmeline Moore effect, we name it, in the time series. These are all the publications from Transaction of the American Fisheries Society from the year of their foundation towards, I think it's 2019. I need to update this year. This is the proportional article led by gender. So in color, you will see the proportion of women lead author. And here are the proportion. And this is the proportion of male authors here. And in gray, you see the number of articles. We have an explosion of new science coming from fisheries. But the representation of the woman like a lead author of this paper is about, you can see now, 30% again. So it's basically reflecting what is there in our workforce. If we try to find when we can have this equality in publication, and just using the transactions, is we expect it to just a simple regression to extrapolate this finding will be by 2059, when we truly will expect equality in authorship. Some people may argue, well, this may happen only in transactions, because how about other journals in fisheries? Well, we try to do that. The difficulties is that we have thousands of papers and we need to find full names. And many people use the first initial of their names at the beginning of the publication. And so we, more recent data from Web of Science and Clarivate group, basically they ask for full names. So we can classify full names based on gender. And there is some packages that can do that for you. And we found that less than one third of fisheries publication are led by women in this period, 26 to 2016. I need to again to, and here all these journals that probably some of you will be familiar, this is Canadian Journal of Fisheries Aquatic Sciences, Environmental Biology of Fishes, Fisheries Bulletin, Fisheries Research, COPIA, Transaction of American Fisheries Society, Fisheries Science, and Fisheries, and North American Journal of Fisheries Management. All these journals are those with more than 500 publications a year. And you see the proportion of women as lead authors here. And you can see there is some journals are better than others. And all these here on the bottom, all from the society, American Fisheries Society. So I think the learning about collaboration network will be is really important, and I will show you some additional analysis now that we use using the time series, the database that we had in 2016, when we can find specific names of the every single faculty in tenure track positions in the fisheries workforce in academia. We can link them and who published with whom using this network analysis, basically. So network analysis means simply you can do it using FoodWeb in other social sciences. Also use that basically when you have two nodes and then you have an interaction between them. This is a network, a really simple network. The link in this case, it could be the number of publication between two people. So each node is one person. This is the second person. If they publish together, they will have a link. If you publish more than once, we have a thicker line and so on. So thinner line means they have less publication, thicker line, they can have a more publication between these two. If you add this, you can create more complex networks. Like in this case, one person is publishing with these people here and all of them, they don't publish that only with this person. And the structure of these networks can be extracted based on metrics of network and can tell you about the clustering, tell you about how inclusive it is. So we use these metrics and network analysis in order to understand pattern of collaboration. These are the publishing trends in the U.S. Fisheries Academic Network, basically those 300 faculty we identify by gender and by race from fisheries and wildlife programs in the U.S. again. And these are the publications from this whole network. The single authorship you see in bars are decreasing, and the number of articles are increasing again, as we show with the other journals too. The network is publishing more, so faculty are publishing more because we're more faculty, there are more productivity, the peer review process is faster now, etc. You have many reasons for doing that. One thing that is really interesting, and it's happening in other fields of science too, is the number of authors per article are increasing. So there is no much longer the idea of I have a solo author, I have all the views that we need to resolve this problem. We need more multi-authors in order to have a more successful publication, basically. And we're talking about between 5 now and 6 is more the normal number of authors and more the mean value of those in general. So the network is increasing their publication and the publication is starting to be more collaborative. So how is this collaboration network changing related to gender and related to race? So here is the proportion of the articles led by women and people of color from Fisheries Academic Network. Again, this is the network of faculties. Of course, white and non-white, they are complementary. So if you decrease here, you increase here, you can show this. And women is increasing and men is decreasing again. And again, we are at about 20-25% in the recent years. So again, we are coming back to these numbers of 30%, but less between 1/4 and less 1/3 of the publication workforce leading author are from females scientists. So there is a way that we can follow this over time, right? Because we have all the people and we can track them in Web of Science because of their names and institutions. We can go back on time. So you can make this historical perspective on these networks. And here is a picture of different the full network in different times. This in the 80s, 90s, 95, 20,000. And by color, you can see women versus men. And you see, for example, this group here is publishing here. These two people publish, these three people publish here. And then in the 90s, you started to see more cohesive, more collaborative network. Again, this is only female, males, scientists, men scientists here, one. Couple of women show up here, 95, again, more women in the network, and so on. You can follow, and now in 2016, you have a full network interconnected with different importance roles, right? This is the total number of publications, so bigger circles also means that this author published a lot more than someone who like a really small circle here. And the co-publication is the thicker of the line. Of course, visually you can see this, and similar for most influential positions are not non-white scientists or faculty in this case, and you see the network here again. But visually is one thing. That can we extract some metrics that show these trends and show how inclusive is this network of publication? And we did this, and we used this metric that is really common in network analysis, is the metric named degree. This is the number of edges connected to a node, how many collaborators each scientist has. And you can see this is the degree. This is for gender, and here is for race. And you see most of the lines on the top levels are blue, means they are men, and in orange are women. Here, so you see consistently, men have better positions than women scientists, and similarly, and probably less, and there's some outliers here by race. But basically, we're trying to find most productive networks and how we can learn from those productive networks. And here we have the male, the five most productive networks. So you see, and these are named ego networks. Basically, we rank the top five men, the top five female scientists, and trying to understand how they interact with others. So that can explain a little bit about their successful and how inclusive are those networks. And you see male top five versus females in the bottom panel here. And you see visually that these most complex networks are led by men. So they have more somehow support. Sometimes really highly productive people, you see bigger symbols mean more publication. Highly productive people publish with other highly productive people, right? So they basically feedback each other. In this network, have two or three of them. In the case of women, they have a different strategy there. First, they have more orange circles around them. So the importance of women for women, and we're talking about allies and stuff like that. And this is showing that they are more simple networks. And they usually don't interact with other highly productive women or highly productive men, except this woman number five here. So one of the reasons for this, there is many reasons, and this is from the paper 2016. And we early today, we were talking about these ideas, why we're having these. So we have a lot of, you know, reasons to having people from the same origin. So you see the same color here means that the Midwest, most of the Midwest faculty position are filled by people from Midwest universities. This is the Northeast, same here, more than Northeast University in is filled by university from Northeast. From the West, it's a little bit more diverse, but still dominated by blue here. If you add all of these blue are really important. In the South here, are most of these university are supplying those faculty positions from those same universities. You can interpret it with many reasons here. One is that there is a lot of, you know, probably network relationship, right, between people from the close by universities. This could be good and bad, right? In terms of bringing new ideas, new perspective, that will be really hard unless you are from this university. On the other side, people from this close by university, they usually have topics that are similar. So similar species and systems. So you need people that are more specialized for those systems. So that is required to have people with the knowledge about those systems. So you can take this in a different ways, but just would like to just show this to promote a discussion about that. How we can move forward from this to be more inclusive. And there is some initiatives here and how we can advance to a more sustainable future for fisheries profession in the workforce. There's some examples here. We try to put some ideas about in fisheries, but also people are trying to expand this to a more freshwater sciences. So people from societies, from the base of the societies, especially junior faculty and postdoc and grad student, they are moving forward and pushing the train here. And I need to acknowledge that. And really, it's really great and putting this perspective published so people can read that and think about, yes, we are less diverse, but we want to be more diverse, and people are pushing from the, it's a bottom-up process that I really like to see too. So we try to make these ideas and more like a plan for how we can include or be more inclusive, what we can do as a society, in this case, American Fisheries Society. Put some ideas here, I will repeat them later. But one of the things that we are trying to do now, at least personally, I'm trying to do is like, if we celebrate our diverse members as a model to engage new generations. And we're trying to do this with these two papers that we published in Fishes. One is highlighting the women in science, providing many examples of women in fisheries with different stories from Native Americans, from people from islands, people from management, people from science, how women have been contributed to the fisheries workforce over time, and highlighting these good examples. And the other one is like talking about the life of one of the pioneers women in the American Fisheries Society, so influential, which is Emmeline Moore. And we did this this year too. At the personal level, as individual, we have some tips for people to be more active in this matter. And here I highlighted 7 steps. We all make mistakes without knowing it. And we need to be aware of that. If you have the best intention, I include myself, we all made mistakes with this. And we need to be patient on that. We need to become aware of our own biases, and that will help us mitigate them in the workplace, especially people in science that we are training to learn from your errors, your experiments, your surveys, your hypotheses. We need to become aware of those. Where are my biases? Can I mitigate them in the workplace? And we need to be active to learn and counter and eliminate biases as much as possible. We can mentor or sponsor diverse talent. And these are some problems that we have in fishes, but I'm sure people we have in the different areas. Mentoring or sponsoring someone who has a talent and is from a diverse group is going to be really important, because they be role model for others. We need to promote those talent, diverse individuals in putting in leadership positions, moving up in the ladder, and also create supportive workplace and community in general. And then lastly, is you say something when you see something, especially for those which are in a more privileged position or position of power. If you see something, you can say something, because you will set the tone for the table and for the culture or their own workplace. And we're talking about at the lab level, at the department level, at the college level, even at the university level. And some final reflection related to our research. We have a fishery workforce is not diverse. We are not making diverse talent to the top of this workforce. We need to attract, select, and develop and retain, have a more better retention of diverse individuals, because it's the only way that we can address these inequalities. There has been an explosive growth in fishery publication during the past 50 years. We have a lot of people doing research now. The scientific collaboration could represent an important barrier if you don't address this problem in the development of scientific community, especially if we use science and science metrics to evaluate people, especially the early stages of their career, like a postdoc, grad students. If we don't include them in this scientific collaboration, they will be less competitive to any other position in the ladder. So thinking about that, really important. So in addition to that, if we talent people are left out of science, then we will keep with these dominant ideas remain, and we are going to have a lack of, you know, promotion of new ideas and new approaches, and we are missing these portions. So finally, I would like to finish with the enhancement of diversity in our science workforce has not been spontaneous. And we need to be more active, and inclusion of diversity warrants intervention. And the question I have for you to reflect or think about probably today is, what would you like our science workforce look like? How do you envision your own science workforce in your own place? And what are you going to do about it? And that know that you can do things. And with that, I will be happy to answer any question. And thank you very much for the invitation again.
All right, everybody. Let's give a collective virtual round of applause to Dr. Arizmendi. Thank you so much for that. You know, if you're of a privileged identity, it's uncomfortable conversations like this we all have to have so that we can move these professions forward to make more equitable workspaces for people.
Stay tuned for part 2 as the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast continues the conversation with Dr. Yvonne Arizmendi, the Emmeline Moore Prize winner of the American Fisheries Society for 2020. Special thanks to the Fisheries Podcast for hosting us on their established feed at fisheriespodcast.podbean.com. and for also tackling important diversity and inclusion topics in their normal feed. Also, find us and other diversity and inclusion resources on diversity.fisheries.org. The custom lo-fi music beat was crafted by Darius Armstrong. Look for his music name, Karl Marx, on www.bandcamp.com/releases. We are very grateful to all those AFS leaders and members who have provided support and feedback as we have brought this podcast to life.